So, summary, the elevator summary of the whole last class was this. Detailed balance says that if you, because of the integer of the S matrix, detailed balance can always be achieved if you have a bunch of reactions going, initial to final, final to initial. If you want this to be true for kind of all possible choices of interactions, then the unitary of the S matrix, which is restricting, saying something about the dynamics of things running forward and backwards, the emphasis there is that the unitary of the S matrix is the important thing that goes into this argument and not, say, time reversal of your interactions. So we know that interactions are not time reversal invariant, but unitarity is something which you can take to the bank. And so if you want forward-backward rates to agree for all choices of the rates, then it amounts to saying that the product of all the particle types of the phase-space density over on the one side of the reaction had to be the same on the other side of the reaction, where the plus is for bosons and minus is for fermions. And you remember this was coming from the final state factors because 1 plus n is the lasing factor for boson, and 1 minus n was the Pauli blocking factor. And these n's were coming from the initial states. Bottom line was it had to be the same on both sides. The observation was you took the logarithm of this equation and you had a conservation law. Sum of something on the before the reaction was equal to sum of something at the end of the reaction. And then the idea was if someone hands you a system, you know what all the conservation laws are. It's some small list like energy, momentum, baryon number, electric charge. So that means that that logarithm had to be linear combination of those things. And so then if you solve for n, this was the solution. With some linear combination of the momenta for, so here we've got k is a particle label. So p mu with the subscript k now means the four momentum of this particle. And qa subscript k now means the charge carried for some, we've got a bunch of conserved things, q, which I'm labeling by a. It runs over, say, 1 to 6 or whatever the number of conserved things are you have. And whereas k runs over all the particle species you might have, which might be 35 or something in the standard model. There's an implied sum here over a and over mu because we're using the summation convention. The k is a dangling index. So for every particle type, you have a sum, a distribution that depends on the momentum and the charges carried by that particle type, weighted by some factors. And mu a is they're conventionally written beta. There's a factor of beta, which is 1 over the temperature that's scaled out conventionally. And what's left is what we would call the chemical potential. We have 1 for every conserved charge. And then there's a similar thing for momentum and energy. We have a coefficient for each of those. And I've now, what I called beta mu last time, I'm now writing as some normalization beta times a four velocity u mu, which is normalized which is normalized in the following sense. So beta mu I've called beta times u mu, where u mu satisfies that its square is -1, as you would expect for a time-like vector. Good. So I'm sometimes going to talk about a chemical potential which is not labeled by the charge, but it's going to be labeled by the particle type. What I mean there is just this whole combination that's appearing. So the sum over particle types of charges of charge types of the chemical potential for that charge weighted by the charge of the corresponding particle is what I mean by the chemical potential for that particle. And it's just notation, if nothing else. It's also true for a reason you'll see in a second that I'm going to be interested in the case where u is purely in the time direction. And basically, that's a choice of frame. It's going to be convenient to work in a frame where, on average, the fluid we're talking about is at rest. But you don't have to do that. You can work in any frame you like. It's one of the Weinberg's three laws of theoretical physics. I can't remember which one it is. I think this is the second one. It says that you can use any variables you like. But if you use the wrong ones, you'll be sorry. And so we'll use the frame where the net momentum is zero, because essentially this thing is playing the role of a chemical potential for momentum. And in the same way, I'm about to argue that if mu is zero, then the net charge density for the corresponding charge is also zero because the particles and antiparticles are canceling. And there's a similar story if these spatial parts of u are zero, then the net momentum will be zero. And that's kind of, I'm telling you that that's the, I'm choosing the rest frame of the universe when I say this, but I'm going to prove that to you in a second. Good. Now, the important thing about this definition is, so once we've chosen that frame, then this whole story here boils down to the one you're used to, beta times E, because this U zero, because of the normalization condition in our metric, where the time component of the metric G zero zero is minus one, just says that this is one, so we have now beta times energy, because P zero is energy. And then this is just what I called mu sub k. And this is what you're used to as the phase-based distribution in normal systems. Important thing is that for antiparticles, you do not have options in how you choose these charges. If you've chosen a bunch of charges for some particles, like protons, then their antiparticles must have the opposite charges. That's the CPC theorem. And that's at root, what's going on there is that whole story that we talked about of relativity of simultaneity being consistent with quantum mechanics. If you have an event A, and here's the light cone, and here's an event B, people can disagree in the ordering of those events, but the story you tell where a particle goes from here to here, somebody who thought this was earlier has to think that an antiparticle went back, and that only works if the charges are opposite and the masses are equal and a whole bunch of things have to happen. So you have no option about whether or not, once you've chosen the charges of the particles, the charges of the antiparticles are always opposite. And that's true, not true for the energy, but it is true for the charges, and that's kind of why we separate them. So when I do the same thing for the antiparticle, which I'll call mu bar, it'll be the same sum, same definition, but the antiparticle charges will go there, but those are all necessarily minus the charges of the particles, and so this will always be the opposite of the chemical potential for the particle. So a consequence of the charges being opposite is their chemical potentials are always opposite. And the last thing I said was, if we're interested in the non-relativistic limit, which we will be, then we know that the energy that's appearing here in that case is dominated by the rest mass plus a small change, and the small change is typically p squared over 2m, but you might be doing more accurately than that. The functional form won't be so important, but it's small compared to that is an important thing. And so it's useful, because we're always interested in the difference of energy minus mu, in that case to take the chemical potential and think of it as being the mass plus a small change, where small is kind of the same size as the energy, and then in that difference, the masses are dropping out. And so if you go read a non-relativistic textbook, this combination is what would have appeared here, where I'm trying to distinguish by curly epsilon is supposed to distinguish the kinetic energy as opposed to capital E, which is the whole energy, including the rest mass. So you would normally see in a non-relativistic book here, the kinetic energy, P squared over 2m minus mu. And so the mu that they mean, they don't call it delta mu, but they mean but what I'm calling delta mu here. So if you're making the translation between relativistic and non-relativistic, that's all that happened. And physically what's happening is you're thinking that mu is the average cost of adding a particle, and relativistically there's this cost of the rest mass. And so this is the thing that's suggesting with temperature, but the rest mass is just sitting there as a big elephant and it goes along for the ride. So it's not worth talking about it all the time. So that's where we left off. So where I'm going is I want to give the formulas for n for the useful cases, not the phase-based density, but the particle density in space, not in momentum space. And I want to do that. So let's do that. So given that, we know that we're interested mostly in the densities in space versus phase space. So given the definition, these things were the particle densities in phase space. What I would do for the density in space would be to integrate over the momentum part of it, because in principle, these are functions of both position and momentum. The momentum is explicit here, and usually we're interested in things that are not varying much in position, but they could have been in principle. So the particle density as a function of position will be just the integral d3p for 2 pi cubed of n. And then all the other densities are also derivable in the same way. So the energy density, which is what we're using in cosmology, will be integral d3p 2 pi cubed. But we have to weight every momentum by its energy. So we'll have E k of p. This is the energy density in particle k, particle type k, times n of k. The momentum density, if we have, say p in particle type k, would have been the integral d3p over 2 pi q cubed of p times nk. And the I was kind of torn for what a good variable was for the density of a charge of a conserved thing. I don't want to use sigma because that's my natural inclination, but that's what I'm going to call cross sections. So why don't we use zeta. So zeta A, just because we're not going to use zeta for anything else. So this is the number density of particles. This is the energy density of number density of for particle type K. This is the energy density in particle type K because it's weighted by energy. This is the momentum density in particle type K. And I want to write now the charge density for these various conserved charges for particle type K. So it's the same thing, except it doesn't depend on momentum. So we can just write it as being QAK times interval D3P over 2 pi cubed. And so that's just QAK times the density, number density. But if we want to just track this, this is what I've written here is the contribution of particle type K to the charge density. So what we should be doing now is summing over all the particle types if we want just the charge density, the total charge density. In the same way that if we want the energy density not just in particle type K, we would sum over particle types. And here, if we wanted the total momentum density, we would sum over particle types. If we wanted the total number of particles, we would do the same thing here. Right, that's important. So that the A label, so A would be equal to, you know, charge, electric charge, baryon number, lepton number, and whatever you think is conserved. And K would be your electrons, positrons, neutrinos, protons, neutrons, whatever you think is around. And you can kind of see here, so if I write the sum over K here, it's really useful because of this observation of the charges being opposite to group the particles and the antiparticles. So this would be, so K is equal to particles and antiparticles. And so if I, since I know that the antiparticles have the equal and opposite charge of the particles, I can also write that as sum over K of equals particles and not separately the antiparticles of QKA of NK minus N bar K. So if I'm just taking this sum is always over any particle that's different from an antiparticle. The two terms in the sum here, they have this, their Qs are related by a sign. I'm just making that explicit. So maybe I should use a different, let me use L or something. So imagine that if K runs over all everything that's around, imagine that L doesn't treat these guys separately. So L would be the species of particles. So here we could have had neutrinos, antineutrino, proton, antiproton, neutron, antineutron, but this would be only over electrons and not their positrons, neutrinos and not the antineutrinos, protons, neutrons. I guess we could also have photons, which are their own antiparticles. So this is, if you like, the species label, and this is the particle labels, and this is the charge label. So all I'm doing is I'm trading the sum over all K is the sum over L plus the antiparticle for L, and I'm just making that explicit. Good. So now the statements I made about when things are zero, so the kind of some zeroth order statements are, so if, in this case, mu sub A is zero, that means that we know for free that mu sub K is zero. This is for all A, for all K. And then that means that n bar of k is equal to nk. And we know that because the distributions are just the integrals of these n's, the curly n's, and the curly n's depend only on the energies and the charges. So because the mu sub k's have charges in them. But if the mu's are all zero because the mu sub a's are all zero, then it's only the energies that could be different. But the energies in relativistic systems are always, you know, this is always really defined to be the square root of mk squared plus p squared, because that's the only thing that's allowed by relativity. And so they can only differ by the masses, but the same argument says that the masses have to be exactly the same, so you have no option in making their masses different. So once you've made the chemical potentials the same, you've made their particle densities the same, and then you've made the zeta zero. So we know that mu equals zero always makes the charge density zero. And so that also shows you that if we make mu not zero, so mu A unequals zero is can be chosen to set the equal some preferred value, some given value. Let me just not emphasize it. If I allowed this to depend on position, I guess I could make that a position-dependent statement if I wanted to. And remember, physically, what's going on there is collisions are fast. They're erasing everything that changes collision by collision. But what's special about conserved things is that it's not changing. That's the thing that is not changing collision by collision. And so the only way you can change it normally is you have to physically move it around somewhere. And so if you're tracking long-time things, the kinds of things that can persevere for long times are the conserved things. And so, you know, the math is telling us what we believe anyway, that we have a knob for every one of the things that's not changing by much. And the reason it's not changing by much is that it's conserved, and that's why they're special. For momentum, same kind of thing is true here. So if, you know, beta I, let me use that for a space index, is zero, or so the spatial part of beta is zero, then the momentum density that we have over there is the sum over k of integral d3p, 2 pi cubed p for each particle times the density. And so again, if this is true, and if the energy density is a function only of the momentum modulus and not the direction, which is certainly true for the relativistic systems where it's the square root of p squared plus m squared, then rotational invariance tells you that this integral has to vanish because you're integrating things that are all scalars here. Do a rotation, there's no vector for it to be equal to. But if this had been if you had a direction dependence to the energy, or if you had a non-zero beta, then in N you would have now had a vector that this thing could have been equal to. And so if you did this integral, you could have something which would survive because there's a vector that it can take the value of. So when I say I'm choosing the rest frame of the universe, this is why. That choice ensures that this average momentum is zero. And so why would we not do that? All right. So far, so good. So now we need to know what these things are explicitly for some simple examples. So it's convenient. So let's just do that integral. So n of nk, we're interested in how it depends on the temperature and on the chemical potential. So that's the integral. I'm just rewriting it, d3p over 2 pi cubed. I'm just writing out now what the density was. It was e to the beta e minus mu minus or plus 1. It's always true the bosons are the top sign and the fermions are the bottom sign. So it's useful to just scale out, you know, the dimensional analysis allows you to scale one variable out. So let's scale temperature out. So we've got three powers of momentum here. So let's use dimensionless variables where we think of, we'll define y to be this depends on the mass that's hidden in here. It depends on the temperature, which is explicit, and the chemical potential. So let's define y to be the mass divided by the temperature, and zk to be the chemical potential divided by temperature. This is what you would call the fugacity or something. And then we'll use the integration variable, which is p over t. So then we know that nk is equal to t cubed times some pure number, which I'm going to call c. And I need another later letter. C CR, let's say. It depends on Y and ZK. So it's a dimensionless thing. And C is just, so this is what I'm going to call C0. And the energy density in particle K is going to be T to the fourth times C1 of Y and ZK, where CR of Y and Z is just the thing that you get here by putting in all the dimensionless things. So we're going to have, so the angles we can do for free. So we're going to have the angular variable here is going to give us 4 pi solid angle. We're dividing it by 8 pi cubed. So we're going to get 1 over 2 pi squared integral from 0 to infinity dx. X is the modulus of this thing. We'll have the x squared from the measure. And then we'll have, if we're doing the energy density, we'll have nothing else here. But if we're doing the particle density, we'll have nothing here. But if we did the energy density, we would have had the energy here. So I'm going to have a factor of x squared plus y squared to the r over 2. If r equals 0, that's 1. If r is equal to 1, this is the square root of p squared plus mass squared. Then I have the denominator, which is e to the square root of x squared plus y squared minus z. So it's just some integral you can do. And you know the usual shtick is that if it's true that the difference beta, so if the difference between energy minus mu is much smaller than the temperature, then this argument here is very close to 0, and then the exponential is very close to 1, and then you care about this factor 1. So the degenerate case, statistically degenerate case is the case where you know bosons are different from fermions, so you're seeing the quantum statistics, and that's when the 1 is important, and that's the case where E sub k minus mu sub k is much less than the temperature. But then the Maxwellian case, and it's not really Maxwellian if we're talking about relativistic systems, is the, let's just say non-degenerate then. Is when is the other limit. And the nice thing is that in this case is the one that's mostly useful in cosmology, and it's the one that where the integrals are much easier to do. So now we just do a couple of special cases. Let's take the case of massless particle with mu sub k equals 0. So that means that we have, y is equal to z sub k is equal to 0. Then these integrals you can just do analytically, and so then you have that. Just want to quote the answers because we're going to use them. So then n sub k of t is so probably the way I want to tell you this is let's talk about what the c's are. So c1 of 0, 0. In that case is just I should distinguish the signs here, so I should also say bosons and fermions. So for bosons, that integral will be the usual thing. It's 7/8. Actually, no, my notation is I'm just writing the sign that's explicit here, right? Minus or plus. So that minus means that minus, that plus means that plus. So this is the fermionic answer part. That's the thing that's 7 pi squared over 240. So that means that for the total energy density, so the total energy density is a function of temperature. If we have a gas of these things, is the thing that you're used to. It's going to be the number of bosons plus 3/4 the number of fermions times. Pi squared over 15, if I remember right, times t cubed. And the energy density is the number of bosons plus 7/8. So what I've used here what C0 was, so I should tell you that too. So C plus 0 is 3/4 C minus 0, 0, 0. And the pi squared of 15 is actually wrong, I think. No, no, that's all right. That's good. So C plus is, and that's equal to 3 over 4 pi squared. Oh, there's zeta. I said I'd never use zeta. I'm going to use it once. So this is the Riemann zeta. I'll call it zeta sub r. So let me just put in the number here, actually. Because what you really care about is the number, 0.1218 t cubed, and this is 0.3290 t to the fourth. So this is the thing that you, I'm sure, saw in the other classes, because, and this is also what you would call G star, right? This is the thing that's counting the number of bosons, the number of fermions, and which one you mean depends a little bit what question you're asking. And these factors are just coming from the integral differing because of the statistics. We could do the same thing if mu was not zero, although it's not such a useful thing in practice. For anything I'm going to want to do, so I won't do it. But it's harder to kind of get closed form answers in that case. At some point in the past, I called this coefficient for a boson the a sub b. So the a sub b, you can read off. This is a Stefan-Boltzmann constant. Like last class, I said that the energy density for radiation was a sub b times t to the fourth, and this is telling you what that is in terms of zeta functions and pi's and things. Actually, it's not zeta functions, it's just pi's. I think it's pi squared over 15 times the number of degrees of freedom. So if I write that again, you know what it is explicitly. All right, now for non-relativistic particles, we have that the energy is the mass plus p squared over 2m. That's what I'm going to take as a non-relativistic to mean. So if mu sub k is 0, so let's do that one first. We can again do the integrals. So in that case, so then, for example, the let me give you the integral in the way I want to give it to you, which I've lost now, so I'll just tell you the answer. Here we go. So the integral we need is C plus or minus R, which we're tracking as a function of the mass now, because this mass is not negligible compared to the temperature. So what we're doing is we're taking ZK is 0, but mu is not, Y is not 0. So that's, I take the definition and I put in these approximations. This is e to the minus y over 2 pi squared integral 0 to infinity dx of x squared y plus x squared over 2y. So that's just the energy to the r, e to the minus x squared over 2y. And those integrals you can explicitly do, and it's just y over 2 pi to the 3/2 e to the minus y times 1 if r is 0, and it's y plus 3/2 if r is 1. And so that gives you the usual formulas that the number density is going to, if I use that expression, it's going to be mt over 2 pi to the 3/2 e to the minus m over t. And the energy density in this case would be the number density times the mass plus 3t over 2. And we're getting the answer that we got. Remember, I kept telling you that gamma equals 5/3 was the monatomic particle. And so this is the expression. This used to be t over gamma minus 1. So gamma minus 1 would have been 2/3, and that's where the 3/2 came from. And we kind of locked ourselves into that when we just said we had a monatomic particle here. No other degrees of freedom, and the energy was that. So that's where that formula came from, if you weren't sure where it came from before. And of course, the thing that's striking about it is that when the temperature gets smaller than the mass, this number density is just going to the floor, because for the relativistic case, everything is proportional to some power of temperature. As the temperature falls, everything goes down, but like a power law. But here, if the temperature is bigger than the mass, then things are a power law. It's not quite the same power law, but it's kind of the fact that it depends on mt rather than t is also fairly clear, because in the integrals we're doing, we're always looking at e to the minus beta energy. And for the non-relativistic kinetic part, that's just e to the minus p squared over 2mt. And so mt is always appearing as the scale in your integral. That's why it's coming out in the end. This factor is just basically that factor. And but the fact that this is dropping like a rock once the temperature gets smaller than the mass is telling you physically something that you believed anyway. That's telling you that in equilibrium, the number densities are really, it's telling you that the what you believed in equilibrium should be true, that states are Boltzmann suppressed once the energies of interest are very high compared to the temperature. And physically what's going on in relativistic systems is that that's the reason they're Boltzmann suppressed is always because in this detailed balance argument, you've got reactions going both ways. But once the temperature, once you have energy levels that are higher than the temperature, so here's, you know, E high and E low. As long as the temperature is high, the reactions go both ways and the energy cost is not a problem, because on average, all the collisions have, on average, their energy is given by the temperature. So if the temperature is high, you've got enough energy to go both ways. But once the temperature falls below the higher state, then although the amplitude for the reactions to go both ways is the same, you don't have enough energy to run the reaction up. So then the reactions start to preferentially take you from populating this state into populating this state. And as the temperature comes down, these guys become exponentially unlikely to be populated. And the mechanism for that in a relativistic system, because here m is the thing we're counting as a level, is that these guys can always annihilate with their antiparticles and give you lower energy states. And it's always true that those reactions can be run backwards to give you the higher energy states. So E plus E minus can always go into two photons, and that can go backwards. Two photons can collide to give you E plus E minus. But once you start making the temperature below the electron mass, this way doesn't go very often, because the photons on average don't have enough energy to make the electron and the positron, whereas this way still goes. And so you start losing all these relativistic particles with this factor. And so whatever that is, that's not describing protons in the universe, because protons in the universe, although we do believe they have this, we think they're more abundant than exponentially small. Even though the temperature now is a degree, which is 10 to the minus 4 electron volts, and the mass of the proton is up there at a billion electron volts. So we know that there are some systems, some non-relativistic things, for which the chemical potential has to be important. And there's other ones for which it's not important. And so an example where it's not important is this one. Electrons and positrons will annihilate. And once they do, well, actually, I lied to you a little bit there. If it were true that there was no chemical potential for electrons and positrons, then they would annihilate. And once you went below the temperature corresponding to their mass, they would both disappear, because you'd lose electrons and positrons. What's happening for electrons and positrons, the reason you have electrons is that there's two chemical potentials running around. One of them says that there has to be a net excess of baryons over antibaryons. So when the temperature falls below the proton mass, you didn't lose all the protons and the neutrons. So there's a chemical potential somewhere. So the fact that, so since protons, neutrons, and electrons exist, and the temperature is much less than their masses, there must be chemical potentials doing that, and there's two of them. So there's the baryon chemical potential for baryon number ensures an excess, a non-zero density for baryons. Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, my notation for zeta was an upper thing. So zeta b will be the charge density for baryons. But that wouldn't do anything for the electrons, because they don't carry a baryon number. But we also want the universe to be electrically neutral. So we should also have a chemical potential, given that we're going to have an excess of baryons. If we really had only the baryons and not the electrons, then we'd have an excess of charge. and that should be a bad thing. So we're going to have to design in a chemical potential for electric charge. And so that will give us a non-zero zeta q. And now because the electron and the proton and the neutron carry those charges, for the proton what will happen is that we'll have the baryon number and the electric charge will contribute in the sum for the proton. But for the electron, only the electric charge will contribute. So actually, maybe what I can do is I can do that here. Since I wrote it down over here, let me just do it here. So this sum in practice, if we ever need to use it, so given that we're going to have an electric charge, chemical potential, and a baryon number chemical potential that's non-zero, things like the proton chemical potential will be, what you need is a charge table. So if we have protons, neutrons, electrons, positrons, baryon number, electric charge. Protons are baryon number plus one, electric charge plus one, zero. I guess I should have the antiparticles. P bar, N bar, E plus, E minus. We have minus one, minus one, minus one, zero, zero, plus one, zero, minus one. So then we just read off that the proton chemical potential will be, the baryon chemical potential times plus one, plus the charge chemical potential times plus one. The antiproton chemical potential will be the minus the baryon chemical potential minus the charge one. So it's, as advertised, it's the opposite of that one. But say the neutron chemical potential will be mu b with nothing else. The electron chemical potential, E minus, will be minus mu q. Positron chemical potential will be plus mu q, and so on. So by saying what the conserved charges are that we think the baryon, that the universe is carrying, so we're actually saying it does not carry electric charge. So actually, I think I'm lying to you here. Yeah, I think I've lied to you. Nothing morally wrong, but so the mistake I made was I'm making it sound like you have to design that the universe is electrically neutral. Whereas I told you before, if I don't give you a chemical potential for something, that charge density is going to want to be zero. So so it's true that there's an excess of electrons compared to protons, but I don't have to derive that by having a non-zero chemical potential for electron charge, I don't think. I'll have to check that, but I think I'm lying to you when I say that, because if I don't put in a chemical potential for electric charge, what should happen is that the net electric charge will be zero, but because I've got an excess of protons, then I'll have to have an excess of electrons to cancel it because of the fact that the electric charge is zero. And the thing that's odd there is that the masses are different. So put a question mark over not whether or not we need this or not. That's something I'll have to, it's not fresh in my mind. But you can kind of see that if you need the knob, it's there, but what you're dialing is the charge. And if you had the chemical potentials, this is what the charges would have been for the particles. All right, so we've done the cases of the explicit formulas for what happens when we have no chemical potential. So now for the non-relativistic case, when mu is not zero, so let's take a particle not zero, then that's a useful formula because that's the case that we're interested in. We want protons and electrons to be around. So what changes there? So then we'll have, so I'm just again, just plugging into the formulas we have over there. It's going to be, so it's again, one over, what's the way I want to write it for you? I'll just tell you the answer. So it's again, it's m times t over 2 pi to the 3 halves. The difference is that we now have e to the delta mu over temperature. you can kind of see that that was going to happen because in our integrals, you know, we're in the non-relativistic case, so we're this difference E minus mu is really E minus delta mu, curly E minus delta mu, that's why we have a delta mu. So so to the extent that we know that it's non-degenerate, which I probably had to assume here, so I'm assuming here that, that E minus delta mu is much bigger than the temperature, which is true in the cases of interest for us. The way you figure that out is you ask kind of what delta nu what I would need to get the density of particles that I have and work backwards to see whether or not this is true. And it is true in practice in the universe. So in that case, this is dominating the plus or minus one. So it didn't matter if they were bosons or fermions. And you can see that once I've got this the integrand we had, you know, the thing that was in the integrand was, it used to be, it's going to be e to the minus epsilon minus delta mu over t. We're doing an integral d3p of that. And so all that's happening is that this delta mu over t is just coming out of the integral because it doesn't depend on the momentum, and that's kind of where that factor came from. So its dependence is quite simple in the non-relativistic case, and you can kind of see how you would have to adjust delta mu is fairly easy to read off from what you want to assume about the particle numbers in this non-relativistic case where it's not degenerate. Which is a case of interest, of usual interest in cosmology. Good. So now where we want to go with this is we want to know we're going to have some species of particle which we want to be dark matter. We're going to imagine that it was once in equilibrium. We're going to imagine that its mass is large. I told you 100 GeV is kind of a benchmark, but we might play with that. But we're interested certainly in temperatures that are lower than that, so it's heavier than protons and neutrons are. So it's going to go into this non-relativistic regime. We want there to be some left over. We'd hope it'd be better not to have to dial how much is left over. So the vanilla thing to try is, so let's imagine that we have dark matter that has no chemical potential but which is now non-relativistic, and then ask, you know, what would be the abundance? We know that there's going to be an abundance that's going to be small compared to what it was at that time, but that time was the time when it was in equilibrium was in the remote past when the temperatures were large. Once the temperature falls below the mass of the particle, they're becoming scarce because of this exponential depletion of their number. And so this formula, if this formula was true now, they wouldn't be useful for dark matter because there'd be so few of them because the exponential would be so incredibly small that we wouldn't care. What has to happen and what will happen is that these formulas, they all assume equilibrium because they all go back to this distribution here, and that was coming from detailed balance. And so that means that everything on the boards now is assuming equilibrium, but what we know is that equilibrium is in general not going to survive in an expanding universe because in an expanding universe, the densities of particles is falling. Either like a power law, if it's relativistic, or like a rock, if it's not relativistic. But in any case, once the density has become too small, the argument that led us to this distribution was in the end of the day, we had reactions going both ways, and we asked that those reactions have the same size. But the reaction rates were all proportional to these densities. That's where this factors of n without the ones came from. And if those densities are small enough, eventually the particles won't find each other and the reactions will stop. And then the argument that we have detailed balance will fail. And so then all these formulas will be wrong. And so, yeah.
What is the typical temperature whether we assume the dark matter to be in equilibrium?
That's fine. Hold that thought. But a rule of thumb would be if it's a non-relativistic thing. So the question becomes, I have to make more precise. I'm making the case that as n falls, eventually the reactions turn off, and then the detailed balance fails. And so the question will be, at what value of n do the reactions turn off? And so the short version of the next lecture and a half probably is actually I hope it's not that long, but it into the next lecture a little bit will be that. What we have to ask is if detailed balance doesn't isn't true, how is it affecting the density of particles? And this, and you'll see that there's two things that are appearing there. One of them is coming from the reaction rates, that's the detailed balance part of it. And the other thing is coming from the expansion of the universes, which was making the temperatures fall. So there's a competition there, and what'll happen is that when the reaction rates essentially are, the reaction rates are falling because the density of particles is falling, and once they fall below the Hubble expansion rate, then what happens is that the expansion of the universe is too fast to allow them to catch up. So that'll be more or less the criterion, and you can make it more precise by being careful about what the, how the densities are tracking both those things together. So in practice, what'll happen is you'll have to know what the interaction was that was keeping things in equilibrium. The properties of equilibrium didn't care what the reactions were, but when equilibrium fails, does care about what the interactions were. The stronger the interactions are, the more you're going to like to stay in equilibrium. But for non-relativistic systems, what will typically happen is that as long as you're in equilibrium, the exponential is there, and that's going so fast that what's going to happen is that the temperature is going to be roughly the mass of the particle within factor of 10 or something like that. And so it's going to typically be true for this kind of a freeze-out that we're talking about m over t, which is not too big, for, different from 1. And so, but the main part of the story will be because it's exponentially sensitive to it, you're going to want to know exactly where. And so that's the, my next job is to set up that criterion and to track it through for this non-relativistic case. But this is the one we want to follow for dark matter. This is the WIMP thermal case. That, so this abundance, I want to make, the WIMP miracle is making the case that this vanilla thing where you're not designing anything in it at all works if the masses that are you're talking about are in the, you know, the hundreds of GV range, and the interactions that are controlling your rates are in the weak interaction range. That's the precise way in which they'll get related. But then the miracle part of it is that you're not designing in anything by adjusting the thermodynamics of it. You're just taking what you get by letting things freeze out. So to set that up, let me just write the equation that we're going to need. So the Boltzmann equation, basically. So as n falls, eventually the reaction rates also fall so far that equilibrium fails. And we want to know precisely when and how long does it take. So what we need to do is go back to the thing, the detailed balance statement. So if, let me go to a board that you can read. So if detailed balance fails, the question is how does n of t evolve? And so the argument is schematically that, you know, you've got a piece of phase space, so there's a little volume d3x, d3p. You've got reactions that were scattering into it, and you've got reactions that are scattering out of it. The thing that we made balance and detailed balance was we made these things the same size. But if they're not the same size, then what should happen is that the things inside this volume should be going down or going up. So morally speaking, what we're looking for is the Boltzmann equation. There's this great book on statistical mechanics from the, you know, the mists of the past, which starts off, the preface for it starts off, it says, Boltzmann was a hero of statistical mechanics, and he committed suicide at a young age. And then it says that Ehrenfest was another hero of statistical mechanics, and he committed suicide at another young age. It says, now it is your turn to learn statistical mechanics. So whenever you see Boltzmann or I think it's Ehrenfest was the other one, that it's a very dour. Anyway, we want to know what's going on. It's an equation which says the rate of change of the density in this phase space cell is given by this difference, which is no longer vanishing. So it's going to say that the rate of change, which I'll be more explicit about in a second, of n, which is the number of particles there, should be equal to c, which is called the collision term. And it's basically the difference between the things that we were making balance. So this side is the rate of change, the explicit rate of change with respect to time. But another thing that could happen is that particles could flow in from different, moving around. So X and P is changing because they can move besides scattering. So N is a function of time, position, and momentum. So part of the time dependence could be coming from the time dependence of the positions or the time dependence of the momenta. So we should have dN dx times dx dt. And then we should have dN dp. And then in principle, that would be times dp dt. And I've left space there because in flat space, that would have been true. But in curved space, you know that the, what you really want to do is the rate of change of if this is like the tangent to the tangent to the world line of a particle. What we want here is the rate of change along that world line. And so that'll have a connection piece. It'll be gamma I j k. Let's not use k because I've used that. S p j p s. And that'll be equal to the collision term. And the collision term is the thing that we talked about before. It's morally, you know, the sum over all, initial, final. I don't need to be too explicit because I'm not going to actually use much of it. Ends of the rate to scatter in minus the rate to scatter out of the cell that we're talking about on the left-hand side. So previously we were making this zero, and then we learned something about this. And the thing that I wanted you to remember for next class is there's two ways in which the right-hand side could have vanished, two very different ways they could have vanished, and they're going to have the same implications for the left-hand side. So the right-hand side could have vanished if we had an equilibrium, because then these distribution ends are such that this right-hand side is zero, and then that says that this is zero, which is saying that the rate of change of the distribution is zero because the scattering is so efficient. But the other way the right-hand side could vanish is that the interactions could turn off. If there are no interactions happening, there's no scattering happening, the right-hand side is also zero. And then N will do a very similar thing to what it was doing in equilibrium, but not exactly the same. So this could vanish if equilibrium. So that's a case of very fast reactions, or if no interactions. That's a case of very slow interactions. This is telling you about forces that are applied that are changing the momenta because you've got a particle and it's just being pulled around by forces. This is because this being zero is the statement that the particle is moving on a geodesic. So if this is not zero, it means there's something else besides gravity pulling it off of the geodesic. So forces pulling you away from a geodesic. That's what this extra thing made it, was a geodesic. These are the things that are, if you have a distribution that's varying in space, then the fact that things are moving around makes a difference because you could, if there's more of them here, fewer of them here, you're going to get a net flux going one way or another. So this is showing you how inhomogeneities and drift can change things. And typically, we're not interested in these things. We're interested in cosmology and particles that are moving around, not under the influence of some big electric field. So we're going to typically not be so interested in that. And we're not so interested in this because we're interested in homogeneous distributions. So that's not so important. So we're mostly going to track this. And so what's useful is to, if we integrate this with respect to momentum, I want to rephrase it in terms of the particle densities because those are the ones we're going to talk about more directly. So let's just do that, and then we can stop. So remember that N was the integral d3p over 2 pi cubed of curly N. And in cosmology, no one asked me, but you could have asked me, which momentum are we talking about here, the co-moving momentum or the physical momentum? And for stationary things, it doesn't matter. And it's really the co-moving momentum is the one which I was writing because I was not writing any scale factors in cosmology. This would have been, this is what I was really calling K, I guess, when I was distinguishing between, we have the position was A of t times the co-moving position, And so the momentum was, so if we wrote things in terms of integral d3k over 2 pi cubed of some, you know, when we talked about delta, we said that was delta sub k of e to the I k dot x. We were using x, and so we used k was the co-moving momentum that went with x. But if we wanted to instead write this as e to the I something p dot r, then p here was k over a. So what you should be thinking here is that this is co-moving momentum. But what we're really interested in when we write the distribution functions is we're interested in the energies as a function of momentum. We want the physical momentum there, p. So it's useful to think of this as d3p divided by a cubed, or to write this on the other side as a cubed. So what we're interested in is the rate of change of this, because the rate of change of this is what the Boltzmann equation is relating to collisions. So the upshot is that this equation, when these are not important and we're just focusing on this is equal to this, is going to say something like ddt of a cubed n is going to be some integral d3p over 2 pi cubed of some collision term. And so you can kind of see that the competition I was telling you about a second ago, this is how you see it. This thing, if you wrote it out, this is a cubed. I could write this equivalently as saying that n dot plus 3hn is equal to 1 over a cubed times this integral. And so the time frame here is set by the Hubble time, whereas the time frame here is set by collision times. And so what's happening during equilibrium is that this is basically vanishing. And during equilibrium, the number of particles is just doing what you expect. The total number of particles is essentially fixed because it's not changing because of collisions. And then the density is being diluted because the universe is expanding. And if interactions turn off, that's also true, that the number of particles just sits there and it just evolves with time. But in general, if this is not zero, which will happen when you're not in equilibrium, then there's a time change going on here, there's a time change going on here. If this is faster, what can happen is that as n goes down, this can adjust quickly enough that it can always arrange for the right-hand side to be zero. So as n goes down, the different reaction rates are starting to change their relative size, but the abundances can all adjust quickly enough to keep it zero and keep you in equilibrium. But at some point, what will happen is that when these rates are no longer as fast as the Hubble scale, this will change so fast that this side can't adjust, and then you just get, it just won't be zero. And that's where that competition comes from that we're talking about. So good place to stop.